The search for the holy grail of renewable energy storage. I'm NPR Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner. This is ClimateCast. Renewable energy production is booming. But how do we save that energy to power our homes when the wind fades and the sun sets? That's the next big engineering opportunity for renewables. And new zinc-air battery technology is showing some promise. Dan Riker is a research fellow at Stanford University. He was also the Assistant Secretary of Energy in the Clinton administration. Dan, we know about lithium-ion batteries, right? I mean, we all probably carry one around in our cell phones. What about these zinc-air batteries? Could they show promise as energy storage vehicles?
I think the zinc-air battery is an interesting technology, certainly promising, as are a number of other technologies. There's really quite a hot race going on among various technologies to help us store electricity.
And that seems to be the holy grail of renewable energy like wind and solar, this battery storage technology. How fast is that technology progressing, and when are we likely to see this storage problem solved?
Well, so first of all, I want to tell you that storage involves more than batteries. There's a whole host of other non-battery technologies that are also in the race, something called pump storage. There's hydrogen. There's mechanical storage. So there's quite a race going on. We really need to make a lot of progress across many of those because we're producing more and more solar and wind on the grid, and the sun doesn't always shine, the wind doesn't always blow, so we really do need storage. The good news, I think, is we are making good progress across this multiple range of technologies. Costs are coming down, but we still have a distance to go. And if we don't get there, here's the rub in all this, we are going to be literally throwing away more and more green electrons as more and more solar and wind go on the grid. We have that problem actually here in California. On a cool, sunny, windy day in the spring or fall, we actually produce more solar and wind that we can use. And we have to either dump it, as it were, or ship it to other states and pay those other states like Arizona to take it. This is a serious problem.
Let's talk about technology and cost a little bit. I mean, 50 years ago, not many people thought we would have as much renewable energy as we have today. What do you think our energy future looks like 50 years from now?
Well, it's going to involve a lot of the renewables, solar and wind, of course, but also hydropower, geothermal, biomass, and then lots and lots of different storage technologies. We can store electricity chemically in batteries. We can store it by pumping water uphill and running it back through a generator. We can use electricity to produce a gas like hydrogen and then run that through a turbine generator. We can store it as thermal energy in rocks or in salt solutions. So wherever we head with all of these many renewables, we're also going to see a huge ramp up in the storage technologies. And I think that's daunting as well as exciting.
And the business mind in me says there are some economic opportunities there, right?
Oh, there are huge economic opportunities. The International Energy Agency says we're going to be spending tens of trillions of dollars building this clean energy infrastructure all over the globe. So it is in many ways a chance to both do well and do good. And that's what makes it exciting to technologists, investors, policymakers, and others.
I'm an atmospheric scientist, Dan. The atmosphere we know cares about carbon. And this is sort of a technological and political question. The big climate change question, how quickly can we scale up to reduce greenhouse gas emissions as this technology moves forward?
Well, the speed of that scale up depends, I would say, on three factors. I think about it as a triangle. At the top of the triangle are technologies. We've really got to continue to advance both the electricity sources and the storage sources. We've got to put much smarter policies in place at all levels. And we've got to have adequate capital. We need clean energy finance in a big way. That's the third point of the triangle. We've got to put all those three things together, technology, policy, and finance. And if we do it well, we can accelerate what we need to do to confront climate. If we don't, we are going to get overrun by carbon emissions.
And what's your assessment of where we stand? We obviously need the political will to make those changes, right? How critical are the next 10 years for our future climate?
I think the next decade is make it or break it. If we don't get the technologies deployed at large scale and at low cost, if we don't put the right policies in place to keep all that moving, and if we don't have adequate capital to pay for all of this all across the globe, I think we're in deep trouble as the citizens of this planet.
You've worked at the highest levels of energy policy. Are you optimistic or pessimistic at this point about our ability to prevent the worst climate change effects?
I have to say I'm modestly optimistic, and that is because there is so much money to be made with clean energy technology. There's a reason that China has organized its economy to dominate many of these clean energy technologies, solar, wind, storage, hydropower, and others. Often technologies that we invented here in the U.S., but the Chinese, as a government, have decided they want to own these trillion-dollar industries. So, I'm relatively optimistic that from a business perspective, there's money to be made, people are going to deploy them. I'm just hopeful that a good chunk of that will remain in this country, that we will continue to own a lot of these technologies that we invented. As we collaborate with the Chinese and the Europeans and others to address this problem.
You know, I see on your resume that you're working with Google on climate and energy. Why are big companies like Google interested in climate and energy?
Yeah, I worked at Google for 4 years on a climate and energy initiative. There are really two reasons. One, Google is a massive user of electricity. All those data centers that process all those Google searches use huge amounts of electricity. So they wanted to get on top of it from that perspective. But I think Google also saw a great opportunity just to advance these technologies more generally, again, to do both good and do well. So the company saw, an internal need, and it saw an external opportunity, and Google has stepped forward to take advantage of both.
Dan Riker, you're a former Assistant Secretary of Energy in the Clinton administration. You worked with Google as Director of Climate and Energy and now Founding Director of Stanford Center on Energy Policy and Finance. Great perspective today. Thanks so much for sharing it.
Thank you very much, Paul.
My name is Eve Mosher. I'm an artist and self-proclaimed interventionist living and working in Brooklyn, New York. I create works that primarily are focused on either the urban environments or waterways around the world, and my focus lately has been New York City waterways. The High Water Line Project was conceived in 2006 in New York City as a way, selfishly, first me to understand my personal relationship in New York City to climate change, but then as a project to bring greater awareness to the entire city of New York City. We were sort of all in this together, and we need to move forward together. When we draw the high water line, we are mark making on the streets and sidewalks of cities, and generally that means taking a sports field marker out and drawing a blue line, usually about 4 inches wide, throughout neighborhoods that will see more inundation because of climate change. I think it makes visible that which is hard to really relate to. We can talk about this 10-foot above sea level line, but understanding, for instance, where that is in South Brooklyn is very different when you put it on the ground, when you put it in a very visceral and place-based marking way. Drawing lines is also a really powerful action. A lot of times it's used in a really bad way. In this case, it's hopefully used in a way that's building knowledge and power for communities.
Some encouraging job numbers for Minnesota. The Solar Foundation reports solar jobs in Minnesota grew by 48.2% in 2017. That's the second highest growth rate in the nation. More than 250,000 people now work in solar energy in the U.S. That's ClimateCast. I'm NPR Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner.